This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz.
Welcome to this episode of Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro, and I will be serving as your tour guide as we explore the cultures and flavors of the American Midwest. I thought it would only be appropriate to start our journey by visiting with those whose communities truly planted the seeds of the region's harvest, our Indigenous neighbors. There is no way to tell the story of any cuisine in North America without the voices of Native peoples. And I can't think of anyone better to help tell this story than Sean Sherman, a.k.a. the Sioux Chef. Sean was born in South Dakota and is part of the Oglaga Lakota tribe. Now based in Minnesota, Sean has dedicated his work to tracing the lineage of Indigenous foodways and bringing these Indigenous flavors to a wider audience. So, Sean, we are fired up and ready to go and really excited to have you on the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Absolutely. You have an incredible story, and I want you to tell the audience a little bit about your background and roots to put your journey into context.
Sure. So I was born and raised on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. I'm a member of the Oglala Lakota Sioux tribe. All my family was from the reservation. And my mom moved my sister and I off the reservation when I was just before high school age. And I started working in restaurants at a pretty young age. I started working when I was barely 13. And I worked through all my high school and college career. And then after college, I moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And within a few short years, I worked my way up into an executive chef position in the city and never really turned back. So I've been a chef for quite a long time now. And a few years into that chef career, I had this epiphany of doing what I'm doing today, which is really a focus on North American Indigenous foods. And a lot of that was a realization of just seeing that there was almost no Indigenous anything in the culinary world around right. The United States or anywhere. So I really wanted to get to the bottom of what that meant to me and my ancestors.
So, I mean, you're absolutely correct. And I think that anyone would agree that there is, you know, that the Indigenous foodways is woefully absent from the culinary discussion anywhere and is really absent from plates, you know, whether they're in your kitchen or, you know, in a restaurant, which is why I find this so important to talk about as we, you know, really delve into what Midwestern foodways are, because there is such a history and heritage that is connected with the Indigenous foodways. And I know that in part of your work, you have done a lot in tracing the migration of seeds. So you're literally going back to, you know, the actual heart of how these things, you know, how seeds basically migrated across North America or maybe came from a different place and how all of this connects together. I would really, you got to tell us about how you got into tracing the migration of seeds and what that means to the larger picture of, you know, telling the story of Indigenous foodways.
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in history in general and food history for that matter, especially being in the chef field. And when I started studying Indigenous foods, you know, I really wanted to know what were my ancestors eating, what were they harvesting, were they growing things, who were they trading with, how were they storing foods, and all those kinds of questions. And agriculture is such an amazing piece of North American history because it dates so far back, you know. And we look at North American indigenous foodways, where our focus is North America, like I said. So it's, we look at Mexico all the way through Alaska and all of this amazing history. So you look at corn production and it starts way in the southern edges of Mexico and shoots both directions into the Americas, you know, both north and south. So it crawls all the way up throughout all of Mexico, through the entire Caribbean, through the entire eastern seaboard, up the Mississippi and Missouri river valleys, so far up into areas like where I'm at in Minnesota and even further north than me in some areas, and basically everywhere from here to the east coast, you know. And there's so much cool seeds that are still alive out there. So we see all this wonderful diverse collection of corns and beans and squash and sunflower seeds and amaranth and chili peppers further in the south, and there's just so much cool stuff to see. And like, again, like we're lucky that we have so much of this diversity still alive today of these heirloom strains, you know. And but it's something that's really important because we've also lost a lot of seeds over the you know, past time period, and we're just we're doing everything we can to showcase how valuable those seeds are.
So you just said showcase how valuable they are. How do you showcase the these seeds and integrate them into the dishes that you make?
Well, there's been a lot of effort in Indian country across the U.S. and Canada, and people are really working hard towards indigenous food sovereignty, and seed sovereignty is a big part of that. So getting some of these seeds that date so far back and they have direct links to very specific regions and people and cultures, and being able to see these seeds growing in those regions, and people being able to disperse them. And for us in the restaurant and food industry, you know, we're able to work directly with a lot of these indigenous farmers and be able to showcase and create even new recipes using some of these amazing pieces. But it's a constant study in the history of these foods and what we can do with them and how we can utilize them today.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the new recipes that you're working on to again showcase some of these ingredients. But before that, I do want to make sure that our listeners understand what food sovereignty is. It might not be a terminology that everybody is aware of. So could you elaborate on what food sovereignty means to you and what it usually means in this kind of context?
Yeah, I mean, food sovereignty really is, especially with indigenous communities, tied to food security. And it's looking at how indigenous peoples lost so much food security, especially during the 1800s and 1900s, and being removed from their own foodways. So it's all about these indigenous communities having the ability to kind of manage their foods for themselves and to really grow their production of the foods so they could really be secure, you know, because they need to have access to the food. They need to be able to produce them. They need to be able to mandate their own rules around them. And we just want to see that happening more and more because these are really healthy foods and they have very special connections to indigenous peoples. And we just really want to help create a better situation than what's out there today, especially among indigenous communities where they suffer from so much food insecurity. And we see you know, really horrible rates of diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and all of this disease that's happening directly from malnutrition and poor food access.
Right. I mean, there's no question that food sovereignty can be part of the puzzle of solving some of those, terrible epidemics that you see amongst indigenous people in North America. I know that, you know, in your work, you do a lot to support native farmers, growers, and food entrepreneurs. Tell me a little bit more about that work, since we're now on this topic.
Yeah, of course. So as a food producer here in the city, you know, and we're focused on indigenous foods and regional indigenous foods on top of that. So when we started our work way back in 2014, officially being out there in the market, we started utilizing and focusing on using only indigenous food. So we cut out colonial ingredients of things that didn't exist here before.
Like what? Like,
like wheat flour, like dairy, like processed cane sugar, even beef, pork, and chicken, because all those pieces haven't been in these lands for that long, and we wanted to showcase all of this different food. So it was a huge study of wild foods and the agriculture, like we talked about, but also wild game and birds and fish. And there's just so much to explore out there, you know? So we think it's really exciting for people to learn what's literally growing right outside their back door.
And you've put together a nonprofit organization kind of to that end to try to educate the public on indigenous foodways, right?
Yeah.
And give them more of an insight to some of these things that you've been studying.
Absolutely, because we really believe in indigenous education and creating a space for that. So our for-profit business was the Sous Chef, you know, where we had a food truck called Tatanka Truck, and we've had a catering operation for the past few years, which we just sold a couple of summers ago. And we've been traveling around the United States and Canada and Mexico and doing lots of dinners and speaking engagements and conferences. But what we're really focused on is that nonprofit, which is called NATIFS, and it's an acronym for North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems. And this year we're opening up our first unit called Indigenous Food Lab, which is going to start here in Minneapolis. And we were hoping to be open by now, but the COVID crisis hit us really hard and we had to, you know, put it on pause for a little bit. But we're still locked and loaded, and we're going to be opening Indigenous Food Lab this year. And it's going to be a center where people will be able to come and try a food in a restaurant setting. But also, more importantly, there's going to be a kitchen classroom for people to take classes on Indigenous food system education and curriculum. So we're developing curriculum around seed saving and farming styles and wild food and ethnobotany and culinary techniques and food preservation and even other things like crafting and medicinals and language. And,
wow.
You know, all of it. We just want to create a center space for indigenous-focused education.
Well, I'll tell you, if I hopefully I'll get a chance to make it out to the Twin Cities and check this out, because I really think that it would be an incredible experience. And I think it's great that, you know, you're not only being able to support, you know, in other indigenous, you know, farmers and producers and whatnot, but being able to educate the larger public on something that, you know, they may not know anything about, and introduce them to, you know, these agricultural aspects as well as these different ingredients that, you know, maybe they've never come into contact with. You mentioned earlier, and I want to circle back to this, about the recipes and some of these different kind of ingredients. You talked about, you know, sort of the foraging and wild ingredients and game meats. Give us some examples of a dish that you might put together with some of these unique ingredients that you found have history and roots in these North American and regional indigenous foodways.
Well, it's really exciting to think about how much diversity there is out there, number one, because, you know, there's still 573 tribes in the U.S., 622 in Canada, and 20% of Mexico identifies as indigenous. So there's a lot of indigenous groups. And every few hundred miles, you're moving into a whole new different area. You know, it's a different language, different flavors, different religions,
right,
different everything. So what we do, we've been traveling around the United States a lot and exploring all these different flavors, and we just really try to make food taste like where we are.
Well, and you're in the Midwest, and that's what the show's about. So I definitely want to hear
Absolutely.
About those flavors.
Yeah, so when we are making foods here, we're using things like wild rice, walleye, rose hips, blueberries, wild tubers like hopness or sunchoke. And you can literally just like stand in one spot in these forests and these Great Lakes regions and just look around and see all those ingredients right around you, you know? And so we're just really trying to make the food taste like exactly where we are. And there's so much, because the Western diet really doesn't touch so much of this plant life that's around us. And to be able to gain this knowledge of the use of all these plants and these flavors, and especially as a chef, to be able to explore hundreds of different kinds of flavors that are part of our landscape, you know, it's really exciting to come up with all sorts of recipes using that. And we can pretty much do it anywhere. So there's a lot to learn, and we're just looking forward to, you know, discovering a lot of recipes.
Well, and that has to be hard work and a sort of challenging process to, I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, I wouldn't even know where to start to try to identify, you know, and seek out all these different ingredients and seeds and plants and whatnot. I mean, what does that process look like to try to, identify, you know, basically go back historically, identify these things, and then actually find them?
Yeah, well, basically, we just kind of mapped out what is an indigenous food system and how do we apply it to all these different regions. So, you know, we've done indigenous food dinners in Manhattan where there's almost nothing indigenous left there, you know, but we're able to know what kind of plants would grow there, what kind of wild food would be around and is around, what kind of seeds are still alive from some of the tribes nearby there, and what we can get from them and the seafood and the animals. And we're able to put together all sorts of food and dinners and recipes. So there's just a ton of stuff to explore. And, you know, we put out our cookbook, it came out in 2017, and we won the James Beard Award for Best American Cookbook in 2018, that following year. But it has over 100 recipes using only indigenous ingredients in the style that we do it. And it happens to be extremely flavorful and fun and, you know, super healthy for all of us.
That's awesome. And that's a great place for us to wrap up. What is the name of that cookbook so we can check it out as well?
Yeah, it's called The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. And you can find it online or ask
Sioux, your local bookstore. Sioux, S-I-O-U-X, people.
Yep, S-I-O-U-X.
This is great. Sean, thank you for joining us. And I, for one, am going to come out and visit and learn more about these indigenous foodways, because, boy, there's a lot to learn and a lot to enjoy, and it really is the original threads in the tapestry that make up our Midwestern foodway. So thank you for sharing your experience, and thank you for your commitment to the indigenous communities across North America.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back to the show. Well, as you realize, this episode is all about indigenous influences on Midwestern foodways. So before we bring on our next guest, a little programming note. You may notice that the audio quality isn't as good as the last interview, and that's because our next guest was coming from a very remote Native American reservation with very unreliable internet connectivity. So we had to do our interview via phone rather than on the internet. So please be patient with the audio quality in our next interview. I promise it'll be worth a listen.
Well, our next guest is another steward of indigenous foodways in the Midwest region. Maggie Rosu is the executive director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project and leads Native Harvest, which is owned and operated by the White Earth Land Recovery Project. The mission of this organization is to facilitate recovery of the original land base of the White Earth Indian Reservation while preserving and restoring traditional practices of sound land stewardship, language fluency, community development, and strengthening spiritual and cultural heritage. Native Harvest specializes in producing and selling food and artisan goods made by members of the indigenous community there. Maggie speaks to us today from Callaway, Minnesota, a town of about 300 people on the White Earth Reservation. Maggie, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Well, thank you, Capri, for having me. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Absolutely. We're so excited to have you on and to share the story of your community. So why don't you introduce the listeners to your community? Tell us a little bit about where you are and the people of the White Earth Indian Reservation.
So we're located in northwestern Minnesota, on the south side of northwestern Minnesota. We are our reservation is White Earth, and we belong to the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. We are an indigenous people, if people didn't know that. And we have different levels, I want to say, of colonization within our communities. We have some very traditional people and people that aren't traditional. So there's about 4,500 enrolled members that live on the reservation. Our reservation actually has about 18,000 members, with 4,500 of them living here. And that is the population we focus on.
And how do you serve that community?
So some of the things that we do as Native Harvest is we buy all our products, we make a lot of our products, but we also buy the things that go into them from our community members. So if I want to talk about, so some of the things we make are jams, jellies, syrups. We do a cereal mix. We do soup mixes. So, and these are from natural products. So we buy wild berries from our community. Mm-hmm. So the choke cherries, the wild plums, the wild, sumac. So sumac berries, we make a sumac jelly with.
I've never heard of that. What is that?
So sumac is a bush or a tree that grows wild here. There's two types of sumac. There's a white sumac and a red sumac. And we use the red sumac because the white sumac is poisonous.
That would be good to avoid.
Yes. So we make a sumac jelly. We also do sumac tea when we're feeding people. The jelly is absolutely delicious. It's of course sweetened with sugar, but it's absolutely delicious. The tea you sweeten as you want, and it's very good too. So we buy all of the things for wild rice. We buy right off the lake and then finish it with our own finishing mill, rice mill.
These are ingredients. This is produce. These are foods, whether it's grains or fruits that are harvested right there, that are sort of native to the region and familiar to the indigenous community. And so you harvest them and you also purchase them to make into different products, correct?
Yes, absolutely. We, of course, value-added products for our shelves. The other thing, is well, and in the Native Harvest, not really, but Weller goes out and teaches people too about what we can harvest and what we make. So, we do maple syrup, and Native Harvest did produce their own for a long time. The last couple of years, we've been purchasing our maple syrup from local producers. So we have several families around here that make their own maple syrup, and anything that they make extra that they want to sell, we will purchase maple syrup from people. We purchase our wild rice right off the lake as the people come in. We also do purchase finished wild rice from people, but it's we like to finish it because we know that it's been wood parched. So
why is that significant? Tell us why that is significant.
Because wood parching is a traditional activity of what we did in the past.
Mm-hmm. So, what does that process entail?
So I want to say the first thing that happens is, this big fire happens and we put it into what is called our parcher. It's a rice mill, so the first part is the parcher, and you got to keep constantly moving that rice because you don't want it to burn. And what that does is dry off the hull. Mm-hmm. And dries the rice a little bit. The grain is generally... it's fairly dry. The hull is the part that needs to come off. And then it goes through it comes off, and then it goes through a thrasher. So we used to do, thrashing used to be done by people by walking and dancing on the rice after it was parched. Well, now we use, a thrasher that just rotates that rice and it blows it, blows away the casing, the hull of it, the parts we don't need, it blows away. And then there's your rice. You have your rice after it's been thrashed. And then generally our rice comes out at about between a 30 and 40% rate, finishing rate. So if we're buying 10,000 pounds, we're going to come out with between 30 and 40 finished pounds. But that also depends on the year and how the rice crop is.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten up to, I want to say, 45%, which is very good. And rice is really significant to us because it's part of our migration story. So we, of course, come from the East Coast, and as colonization occurred, we, of course, moved west. And one of our prophecies that came to us, or one of the things that came to an elder in a dream, was that we needed to be safe to go as far as where the food grew on the water. And that's where we came to wild rice in this area. And wild rice is in, the only place you can get wild rice is the United States. That's truly wild rice. It's not rice that's cultivated or grown in man-made conditions.
Right.
So, and they call that paddy rice. But I want to say Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and up into Canada.
Well, that definitely shows that the wild rice story is very much part of not only the indigenous story, but the current day Midwestern food based story. As well, which, is one of the reasons why I wanted to engage you in this conversation in this episode. And interestingly enough, you talk about, wild rice being part of the migration story. We also talked earlier to Sean Sherman, a.k.a. the Sous Chef, about his work basically cataloging and tracking the path of seeds all across North America. In order to basically almost reverse engineer and figure out the origins and history of where some of the indigenous foodways came from. So this is, I've learned a lot just in this short period of time from both of you.
And Sean Sherman, Sous Chef, is amazing, and he's an amazing chef. One of the things he did to help Native Harvest was to feature us in the New York Times article that he did. And online he put our link, which was really, really neat because we've seen that the Sous Chef has a lot of followers.
Sure.
Yeah.
One thing that you both have in common, and I'm sure that there are other, indigenous organizations and nonprofits and others that share this commitment, is it seems to me a combination of supporting other indigenous individuals in, making sure that they have an opportunity to get their goods to market. So supporting other indigenous farmers and other indigenous producers. And at the same time, we're educating the public at large outside of the indigenous community of native foodways, the cultural significances, the practices that you guys use in order to produce food and pass that tradition on both internally and externally. And I think that is just incredibly important because, I for one being, an outsider, so to speak, think that we need so much more attention on indigenous foodways, not just in the Midwest, but all across the hemisphere, because it's totally overlooked.
I agree with that, and there's so many things that we do, indigenous people have, for us as Ojibwe, we have traditionally been hunters and gatherers, but as, things happened, we learned to grow those that were traded with other Native American communities or indigenous communities, And one of the things I just want to bring up is, you know, like, we grow corn. We grow corn that is heritage corn to native communities. And so we make hominy, and right now we're out of it because it sells so fast each year.
Right.
But, and we do it in a traditional way.
Yeah, tell us about that, for sure. I definitely want you to tell the listeners about how it's processed and how you pass along those traditional methodologies.
So, you know, in the past it was done over a wood fire. We don't use a wood fire. We use, of course, our gas stove. And we also have a heated pot that we use at times. But you put that corn into that hot, you whip it up in that hot water. And what we do is, traditionally, we used ashes. So ashes from a fire, usually a hardwood fire, such as, as oak. And we take those ashes, and we cook them in with that corn.
And oh, wow.
What happens with the corn, those ashes have a component in it, and I wish I could remember what it is, but I can't, that removes the, you know, how the corn, it always has a hull, and when you pop it, it has that hard hull. So it completely removes that from the corn. Then we, of course, take it out of that pot, drain it, and then we dry it. So hominy has been dehydrated. It's a dehydrated corn that has no hull. And also, some people told me, well, you can kind of taste that ash. Well, I haven't really noticed that because I've grown up with it. But it's a really neat, you know, process to see. It's a really, it's a very much of an indigenous food, not just for us, but also for many, many tribes across the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and usually when people think of the Midwest, they think of corn. You know, that is the one crop oftentimes that, you know, no matter where you're from, you think of, oh, the middle of the country, what do you guys do? Oh, you grow corn.
Yes.
You know, but we have to remember the history and the roots of corn, and is really has its roots in with indigenous communities such as yours. So this is, I mean, again, very interesting to hear. And when you say, oh, people say, well, you can taste the ash, but if you grew up with it, do you share these? People outside of the community and the reservation able to purchase some of these goods that you produce at Native Harvest?
Absolutely. You know, we do have a store, and it's located at nativeharvest.com. And these things, everything that I talked about being produced can be purchased there. I do believe our hominy is marked as out of stock at this time. We also sell dry corn there. And dry corn can be used in many, many different things.
Soups, sure.
And other, you know, it can be processed into cornmeal.
So, Maggie, I know that you've had to change some of your practices and programs due to the coronavirus pandemic. And I believe that previously you did something called the Saturday Meal Program, bringing people together in the community and providing meals. But now you've had to adapt. Can you tell us a little bit about how things have evolved in your programming surrounding food in these very different and challenging times?
And it has been very challenging. So one of the things, you know, you mentioned our Saturday meal program. It was really focused on feeding our families and the communities across the White Earth Reservation and bringing people together with an education piece, as well as, you know, the company and the socialization. Well, since the coronavirus pandemic has happened, we have changed our protocol, and we are now delivering meal kits to families. So when I think about that, we deliver 40 meal kits because, of course, we're on a budget.
Sure.
But one of the things we have had to do is we now find out who needs them. You know, before, people would just come and we would get together, and now we need to find out where people are, where they're located. I got to say, one of the things it's done is connected my staff more to community than before. which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
But it's also been a more expensive route to go, because now more people are receiving food, which I'm really happy, than those that can show up on a Saturday to eat and learn. One of the things we've done, instead of doing, you know, gathering together and doing this educational piece, like we brought a nutritionist in one time, we brought storytellers in a few times. But one of the things we've done that's different is we've put information out into our meal kits. So this meal kit that's going out is going to have the nutrition. We're doing one this weekend. It's going to have the nutritional information on wild rice. It's also going to have the migration story included in it. So that's just part of the education that we're putting out there to the families through this project, which we would have probably had somebody talking about nutrition and also talking about the migration story or sharing some of that in our regular Saturday food program or meal program. But now it's going into meal kits, and families, if they want to learn, they can. If they don't, you know, there's nothing we can do to change that. So, but it's been a challenge, especially because one of the things we're really trying to do is going to the decolonization of our food systems. And so it's been a real challenge trying to get traditional, especially meat. So we were looking at buffalo, and we did do some buffalo, but it's $11 plus a pound.
Wow.
So it's been a challenge to purchase the food at a reasonable price.
Sure. Well, this definitely links back to an earlier conversation, again, I had in this episode with Sean Sherman about food sovereignty. You know, trying to access those traditional food ingredients. But when you have a price point like that, it becomes cost prohibitive in a way that, you know, further erodes your desire for that food sovereignty, making, I think, the work that you do that much more important. Sounds to me like, though, regardless of the challenges that you face as a community on a daily basis, you know, historically, but now with this additional burden of the coronavirus pandemic, the work that you're doing there on the reservation and with Native Harvest, to me, sounds like you have risen to the occasion. You're providing a tool to not only feed people, but feed their soul through bringing them together, giving them education and resources that they can use, and supporting your neighbors. I can't think of anything better.
And through all of this, we're going to, you know, we're going to make it through, and we're going to continue to serve our community. One of the things I just want to say in these meal kits, as we're delivering them to our elder population, we're also being certain to bring out face masks for them, because that's one thing I've heard is people don't have a lot of face masks in our Indigenous community, but we especially want to make sure we protect our elders.
Of course. Of course, that's we all want to make sure that our elders are safe and stay healthy. They're an incredibly important part of our community, and I know our chair is very, in a very special way, in Indigenous communities and hold a very revered position in Indigenous communities. Thank you for your commitment to helping them, to helping your neighbors, and the way that you do. Maggie, thank you for joining the program today. Keep up the great work and stay safe.
Thank you, Capri. And I do want to point out, I said hull with the wild rice, and it's not hull, it's chaff, the chaff of the wild rice.
I appreciate you being technical there, Maggie. That's why that's why you do what you do, and you know this stuff, and we're learning from you. Thanks for clarifying that.
I just want to clarify that. Thank you.
Absolutely, Maggie. Thank you.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.